Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Institute for Philosophy and Religion and the Center for the Humanities titled Personhood and Interpretations of Embodied Cognition. Our speaker is Sean Gallagher, Lillian and Moria Moss, Professor of Excellence in Philosophy at the University of Memphis. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Institute for Philosophy and Religion Director David Eckel.
Professor Gallagher is the Lillian and Moria Moss Professor of Philosophy at the University of Memphis. He lists his specialties very impressively as phenomenology and the cognitive sciences, especially topics related to embodiment, self, agency, and intersubjectivity, hermeneutics, and the philosophy of time. In the Institute seminar that goes along with this lecture series, we know him as the author of a series of fascinating articles on moral agency and practical wisdom in an Aristotelian mode. We discussed that just last week. He's written on torture and solitary confinement, and on the relationship between biblical views of the self and cognitive science. That was an unexpected and fascinating entry into a field that we were not familiar with. It was a fascinating combination of articles, and I don't think it even begins to exhaust the range of his philosophical interests. So please join me in welcoming him to our institute. We are very eager tonight to hear what he has to say.
All right. Thank you, David, and thanks for the invitation to the series of lectures. It's really quite nice. I'm going to talk about the notion of personhood and specifically some debate that has recently developed around interpretations of St. Paul. And this might be the only time I ever have and maybe ever will talk about St. Paul in a lecture. So recent studies of Paul's anthropology have raised, I think, fascinating questions. First of all, about hermeneutics, and especially with respect to the relevance of cognitive science for an understanding of biblical texts. And also, as we'll see, the philosophical framing of what we can conclude from those studies, and specifically what we can conclude about the nature of personhood. Specifically, Susan Eastman's book, Paul and the Person, published last year, has motivated this debate and has motivated just these types of questions. One of the people who's entered into this debate is Michael Spezio. In this year, 2018, he published a critical essay on Eastman, and then Eastman responded to that essay. And the focus was about how questions concerning method and philosophical framing are really intertwined with some deep worries about naturalistic conceptions of personhood. Now, Spezio himself is a neuropsychologist. He has a strong research interest in the connection between religion and science. So he ventures into some of the debates about religious practice and religious texts, but coming at it from a neuropsychological perspective. So here's an outline of what I'll try to cover tonight. First, I want to give you something of a map of embodied cognition, to put you sort of on the map and also to put me on the map, as you'll see. But then I hope quickly we can move to really two of the main issues that I want to address. The first one is about the hermeneutics and the understanding of science about persons. And there, specifically, in this debate, two topics are at stake, one having to do with neonate imitation and the other about mirror neurons, some of the most controversial types of issues in cognitive science. And then I want to move on in the end to some perplexities about the philosophical framing and the contrast between a naturalistic approach and a theological approach to conceptions about personhood. So in mapping out briefly some things about embodied cognition, what I want to do is put Eastman and Spezio and myself on the map, because I think that's important to sort of see why people are saying what they're saying. And in order to do this, I'm going to simply distinguish between three different types of embodied cognition. One which is called weak embodied cognition, another called extended, the extended mind, or extended embodied cognition, and the last one referred to as the inactive approach to embodied cognition. So weak embodied cognition, it's been defined by Allsmith and Vignemont as in contrast to strong embodied cognition, where they say strong embodied cognition endorses a significant explanatory role for the non-neural body itself in cognition, the non-neural body being the bodies that we all have without the brain, setting the brain aside. Weak embodied cognition gives the significant explanatory role to what are called B or body-formatted neural representations. Vittorio Galese, who is also someone who speaks quite a bit about mirror neurons, Alvin Goldman, philosopher at Rutgers, and so forth. Okay, so for Goldman, and this is in an article by Goldman and Frédéric de Vignemont, they define the starting point for the analysis of cognition as, naturally, you might think, the brain, which they define in terms of it being the seat of most, if not all, mental events. Weak embodied cognition, they explain, really rules out things like anatomy, bodily activity, so that would include things like actions, postures. And they think, in fact, that such things are really trivial rather than important if we want to understand what cognition is. These things are not really constitutive of cognition. They also rule out any role played by the environment. So ruling out, in a certain way, the body, the non-neural body, and the environment, you might rightly ask, why are they called embodied cognitivists or embodied cognition theorists? And the answer is in what's left. And what's left are, for them, they actually use the word sanitized body representations. And they think that focusing on body representations in the brain is really one of the most promising ways to approach embodied cognition. So the body that they are concerned with primarily is what some have referred to as the body in the brain, bodily representations in the brain. So what precisely are B representations or bodily representations? And, they define bodily or body-formatted representations as internal neural representations in the brain. And they explain that these are not propositional in form. They're not conceptual in form or format. But they have a special body formatting with reference to the body. And therefore, their content may include the body or body parts, but also they may include action goals represented in terms of how to achieve them by means of bodily action. So action, the environment, the body all kind of come back in, but only via brain processes and representations. And they body representation specifically represent states of the subject's own body, and indeed, they say, represent them from an internal perspective. Jesse Prince, who also talks about body representations, defines it this way. He says, such representations and processes come in two forms. There are representations and processes that represent or respond to the body, such as a perception of bodily movement. And there are representations and processes that affect the body, such as motor commands, which, of course, put the body into movement and action. So the processes involving B-formatted neural representations are understood as purely internal to the brain, and as Larry Shapiro suggests, could easily just as well be thought to occupy a brain in a well-equipped vat. So the philosophical thought experiment of the brain in the vat is a well-known one in philosophy of mind. And the idea is the brain in a vat kept alive and fed information through electronic means or however would have exactly the same experiences that we all have, all of us out here in the world with bodies. But in this case, you would not need a body, right? Because what is cognition? It's simply a kind of information processing in the brain. So in that case, weak embodied cognition is internalist and neurocentric. And as we started out saying, everything of importance for cognition is to be found in the brain processes. In contrast to weak embodied cognition, extended embodied cognition, sometimes referred to as distributed cognition, indicates that the body does play an important role as part of the extended mechanisms of cognition. Indeed, the physical body plus objects in the environment can function as non-neural vehicles for cognitive processes. So things out there in the world, as you interact with them in a bodily fashion, can do some of the work that perhaps neurons would be doing in a more weak conception. And some of you probably know this famous example from a paper in 1998 by Andy Clark and David Chalmers. Example of Otto and Inga. I'll just run through it very quickly. Inga, for example, wants to go to the Museum of Modern Art in New York. She thinks, where is that located? And she consults her own memory, her own biological memory, and she says, oh, I remember, it's on 53rd Street. And off she goes. Otto, however, is having a little problem with memory. He's perhaps becoming forgetful of a lot of things. Alzheimer's might be in his future. So what he does is he writes down things in his notebook, such as the location of MoMA. And then he says, I want to go to the art museum. He has to pull out the notebook in order to try to figure out where it is located, and the notebook tells him, 53rd Street, and there you go. So what Clark and Chalmers argue is that, look, these two people came to the same result, came to the same conclusion about where it is. Inga was using her biological memory. Otto was using his notebook and manipulating his notebook in such a way that he got the same information. So his notebook and his manipulation of it were, in effect, operating in an equivalent fashion, so to speak, to biological memory. And in that case, we have what they would call a case of extended cognition, where our cognition is really being assisted, scaffolded by, it could be your iPhone, it could be your notebook, it could be some mechanism out there in the world. It could be a lot of different things. In that case, non-neural processes that involve body or the environment may be quite different from the neural processes. They may accomplish the same thing, or they might complement or go beyond anything that neural processes could do on their own. Now, most examples of extended mind focus on the use of instruments or tools, but Andy Clark himself suggests that other persons may also scaffold one's cognitive processes in much the same way. So my wife is an art historian, and most of my knowledge about art history is really in her cognitive system. And when I need it, I go to her and I ask her a question. So that would be a case of kind of intersubjective extended mind. Or if Otto met up with Inga, Inga could direct him to the Museum of Modern Art. The third and final kind of embodied cognition I'll just briefly talk about is called enactivism, or enactivist embodied cognition. Enactivist embodied cognition comes with strong calls to radically change our ways of thinking about the mind, and also about how the brain works, and also, by implication, how to do cognitive science. I'm not going to go into all of that, but some people refer to it as radical enactivist embodied cognition. Enactivism draws on phenomenological as well as pragmatist and ecological sources, ecological psychology, Gibson, people like that, to emphasize the idea that perception is for action. It has a pragmatic purpose in our life, and that this action orientation shapes most of our cognitive processes. So, an active perception is for action. We see things in terms of what we can do with them and how we can reach and manipulate them. If you're familiar with the phenomenological tradition, you know that you can find similar concepts in Husserl. He speaks about the I can. That is to say, I see the world in terms of how I can act in regard to it. Heidegger's notion of the zuhanden, the ready to hand, is the idea is that we really, our primary way of being in the world is in a very pragmatic fashion. We engage with the world and we do things. Merleau-Ponty's notion of motor intentionality, all of these nicely fit what James Gibson called the notion of affordance. I think he really had a really nice word for all of this. And he was very much influenced by this phenomenological tradition. He read Merleau-Ponty especially, handed copies out to his grad students and so forth. So I think he found something in the phenomenological tradition that was of use to him in developing ecological psychology. So an active perception is certainly one important aspect of the enactivist approach. Intersubjectivity, as I mentioned, also is important, and in a double-barreled way. First of all, when it comes to explaining social cognition, the enactivists want to emphasize interaction, the idea that we interact with others in a fully embodied way. So they might say something like social perception is for interaction. But also, they want to acknowledge that we're already caught up in and immersed in social intersubjective relations from the very start. They look at developmental psychology in order to see the details of how this works out. And accordingly, our cognitive life develops on that basis. So social cognition, the enactivists really invoke fully embodied dynamical interactions that rely on facial expression, posture, movement, gestures, and distinct forms of sensory-motor coupling and our actions and interactions with others. In contrast, a weak embodied cognition would point to certain mechanisms in the brain, theory of mind mechanism or mirror neurons. And for the enactivist embodied cognition, intersubjective interaction plays a constitutive role in cognition. And this would distinguish it from extended embodied cognition, where we might think that for the extended mind people, others are more or less like tools or instruments that we can use in order to scaffold our cognition, whereas for the inactivists, it's much more seriously involved in our cognitive processes. Okay. All right, now on to sort of the main points I would like to get to. The first having to do with hermeneutics and our understanding of the science that concerns personhood. So Spezio begins his essay on Eastman's work with a very clear cautionary statement about the nature of what he calls pseudo-interdisciplinary scholarship. He warns us about the easy appropriation of ideas from disciplines other than our own, and the dangers involved in ignoring the integrity and unique perspectives found in those disciplines. So I fully endorse this cautionary approach that would add, I would add only that one should be careful not to overlook ongoing disagreements and debates that you find in those other disciplines. You find those in any academic field, but that also includes science. You just shouldn't think science, they just know what they're saying, and that's it. There are debates going on in the scientific realm. So Spezio's caution here pertains to Eastman's use of contemporary cognitive science, especially neuroscience and developmental psychology and the philosophy of mind, in her interpretation of Paul's anthropology. And given Spezio's caution, which I endorse, I found his analysis of some of that science somewhat puzzling. And the first puzzle was his criticism seems to be directed more broadly to the use of naturalistic studies in this context. Specifically in the context of interpreting Paul's epistles or the Bible. I found that somewhat puzzling since he himself is a naturalistic scientist, so he's more or less ruling out, or it seems as if he would be ruling out some of the science. Spezio, however, focuses on two issues, the issue of neonate imitation and the issue pertaining to mirror neurons. And I think he is absolutely right to do so. These are highly debated issues that draw no consensus in contemporary science. So if you mention any of these terms to any number of people, you'll find that they will argue about it. And puzzle two is seemingly in violation of the spirit of his cautionary statement about interdisciplinary scholarship. He straightforwardly proceeds to cite evidence that, on his view and in opposition to Eastman, clearly decides these issues. He thinks that some of these issues are already decided. Now, first, I want to look at neonate imitation. With respect to this question, which concerns some of my own work, that Eastman cites, there are ongoing debates around at least two issues, and these issues really remain unsettled. The first issue is whether there is anything of significance to discuss. Is there a phenomenon there that we are describing as neonate imitation? Does it exist at all? Right? And then there are questions about what is it? Is it imitation? Is it something else? Here is an example, just in case you don't know. This is a 10-minute-old infant being held by his father. And the father does a kind of informal experiment, sticking his tongue out, tongue protrusion. And this was scientifically done by Andrew Meltzoff back in the 70s. And what Meltzoff showed was this, that the infant imitates, or so Meltzoff claims, the infant imitates the father. Some researchers argue that what has been called neonate imitation is not imitation, but mere reflex or a form of arousal. As I said, Meltzoff had provided some evidence to show that it's not reflex. But the most recent argument is that it's really just arousal. That, in fact, the sticking of the tongue out, for example, is just something the infant does anyway. And if the infant gets aroused by seeing a face or something like that, they'll stick their tongue out. So this ignores some of the evidence, but nonetheless, it's a position that a number of people maintain. That view, that it's simply a matter of arousal, ignores the operational definition of neonate imitation, which Meltzoff defined as differential imitation, where he meant the greater frequency of a gesture in response to the same gesture than in response to other gestures. And this is an operational definition that was used in the Meltzoff and Moore studies and many other studies that replicated neonate imitation. Indeed, recent empirical studies also support positive findings of neonate imitation on this operational definition. So this is just to say that at least some people think there's something real there to explain. Whether it's imitation per se or something else, that's a different issue. Now, Spezio cites a study by Ustenbrook and colleagues showing negative results, which, according to Spezio, quote, took most of the wind out of the sails of studies that rely on neonate imitation. The Ustenbrook study, however, averaged data across a large number of infants in differing domestic environments. And there was no control for the variables that might be introduced by those different environments, possible distractors in different environmental settings. That just was not controlled for in the Ostenbrook study. Also, the way that they presented the series of different gestures, they basically presented 11 different gestures, one after the other, in 11 minutes. That interferes with the measurement of what Meltzoff called delayed imitative responses. That is to say, you can do this with an infant, and it might take the infant some time to get the gesture out. So if you're presenting another gesture while they're trying to then do that, then that gesture won't count, right? Because there's some other gesture on the table, so to speak. So just the way the experiment was done, there's some issues involved. In any case, there are ongoing debates not only about methodology and data, but also about the interpretation of that data, whether neonate imitation is really imitation, whether genuine, or people talk about genuine imitation, or whether it's operationally defined imitation, whether it's something more like perceptual priming, or contagion, or arousal. There's a lot of different possibilities here. In any case, this remains an open question rather than something dead in the water or, as Spezio says, now known to be wrong. But the truth is that dyadic interaction can start from either side, from the caregiver side or from the infant side. Even if neonate imitation is not imitation on the part of the infant, it can motivate the caregiver to respond in a typically imitative or complementary way, responding to the infant's spontaneous tongue protrusion with a facial expression. That is to say, the caregiver responds with a facial expression towards the infant, which in turn may provoke further arousal or some form of primary response in the infant. So I think the idea is that it does have something to do with social cognition, even if it's not genuine imitation. So a caregiver may overinterpret the infant's response as a social response, but that just promotes further interaction. So eventually that infant is drawn into social interaction in some way, no matter what this is. So in effect, this early face-to-face encounter, motivated by neonate imitation or some other kind of, I think it's a kind of Levinasian idea of the face-to-face here, of primary responsivity, pulls the infant and the caregiver into a kind of continuing interaction process. And this, I think, is a point that Eastman finds in the work of Vasu Reddy, developmental psychologist, who emphasizes the importance of being imitated, or at least the importance of being engaged in this kind of activity. So whether the capacity for imitation is innate or acquired, that's also under debate, or even whether the phenomenon under discussion is imitation or something else, which is also still under debate, it can nonetheless play an important role in the development of social interaction. So I'm trying to present arguments against Spezio's interpretation there. He also wants to talk about mirror neurons. So he wants to offer a similar critique of the mirror neuron hypothesis. And here again, it's important to understand that there are debates about the methods of measuring mirror neuron activation, the data that is gotten from those experiments, and the interpretation. Spezio contends that there is little direct evidence for mirror neurons in humans. First, of course, we should say that the most significant evidence for mirror neurons were gotten through the study of macaque monkeys. And there, they used a direct recording of single neurons. That's something that ethically cannot be done in the human. And certainly, humans should not be experimented on in that way. So most of the evidence for mirror neurons in humans is the result of indirect and imprecise methods, brain imaging and things like that. However, there is one study by Mukamel and colleagues where single-cell recordings in 21 human patients who had electrodes implanted in preparation for surgical treatment of intractable epilepsy. So in this case, the ethical question is answered. And the results showed that a significant proportion of neurons in the supplementary motor area and the hippocampus met criteria for being called mirror neurons. Overall, 90 out of over 1,000 neurons tested, that is close to 8% of neurons in the areas tested, counted as neurons activated in both conditions of observation, when I see the other person's action, and execution, the one engaged in action myself. Spezio cites this study, but implies that the results were not very significant. He says only an average of 2 neurons per person. Actually, the average is a little bit higher, but it's about maybe 3 neurons per person. In fact, however, given the limitations of where the researchers could record from, and given that approximately 14% of neurons in the supplemental motor area turned out to exhibit mirroring, this looks like highly convincing data for the existence of mirror neurons in humans. It is true that mirror neurons have been the topic of a great deal of hype in both popular media and the scientific literature, and that certainly calls for a critical perspective, and in that respect, I think Spezio is right to look carefully at this. I think, though, that there is very little question about the neurophysiological data. Mirror neurons were originally shown to exist in the macaque monkey, and there is good and growing evidence they exist in human brains. The real debate is about the interpretation of their function. Spezio suggests that I draw heavily on Vittorio Galese's evidence from recordings in the rhesus monkey brain, that's the macaque monkey brain. In fact, however, as Eastman notes, I have been engaged in an ongoing debate with Galese about how to understand activation of the mirror neurons. Galassi interprets mirror neurons as underpinning automatic simulations, which is not far from Spezia's own simulationist view. I reject that interpretation in favor of a more enactivist view that takes mirror neuron activation to be preparatory for second-person response to the other agent, rather than an internal repetition or simulation of the other person's action. So the simulationist has to say that, you know, my neural activation of my motor system is matching what I see out there. And that's a kind of backward view in terms of it's the mirror neurons are responding to something it's already that I've already seen. And the inactivist view is more forward. It's saying, no, it's the activation of mirror neurons are part of the preparation for an action that I'm going to take towards the other. There's evidence on both sides of this debate, and it remains an open question. Regardless of how this debate might play out, it is categorically not the case that, as Spezia suggests, my theories involve now discredited claims about a mirror neuron mechanism supporting some kind of physical signal or code that indicates or underlies a we-centric space. I'm not sure whose theory that is, but it's not mine, and it's not clear how it is now discredited in any case. As I say, my own view is a more enactivist interpretation of mirror neurons, and I would say generally in regard to both neonate imitation and mirror neurons, my own views have evolved and changed according to the evolution of the scientific literature, as the scientific literature has changed also. So the last section here is about the philosophical framing of some of the conclusions that Eastman and Spezia draw about how we go about studying persons. So I think maybe this is a little bit more substantial and on point to the whole question of personhood. First, note that both Eastman and Spezia assume a dualism between a theological framework and a naturalistic framework. The theological framework associated with Paul, which gives us, as Eastman puts it, the concept of personhood constituted through the spirit of the incarnate, crucified, and resurrected Christ. In contrast to a naturalistic framework associated with the science and philosophy which gives us personhood, as she puts it, constituted through the flesh. I think this theological versus naturalism distinction is really a traditional opposition. I think Borden-Parker Bone's anti-naturalistic personalism would, in fact, endorse this distinction, and he would take up a more theological side of things. In contrast, a more inactivist embodied cognition, which attempts to work out a non-reductionistic naturalism, has room, I think, for an important personalist principle, which you find in the work of the French personalist, Emmanuel Monnier. And that is his concept of the relational concept of person. This is what Monnier says. He says, if the first condition of individualism is the centralization of the individual in himself, the first condition of personalism is his decentralization in order to set him in the open perspectives of interpersonal life. He just says personal life. I've added the inter. Monnier here, I think, is really emphasizing something that is very close to the inactivist view about the importance of intersubjectivity. And I think Eastman carries this emphasis on intersubjectivity into her work in her interpretations of Paul. So Eastman's project is trying to explicate Paul's understanding of personhood, in short, his anthropology, including his assumed understanding of what it is to be a human being. Her strategy, in part, is to juxtapose Paul's theological perspective and the contemporary naturalistic theories of personhood that you find in philosophy and cognitive science. So she's looking at the embodied cognition, especially along the lines of the more inactivist view of things, as part of what of her method in trying to work out what Paul might think about the person. These are differences in theoretical perspective, but not necessarily differences in what we're all trying to understand. You know, what is a person? Well, you take a theological perspective, you can take a naturalistic perspective, but we're still studying the same thing, supposedly. I accept that we are likely to get two different kinds of answers about the nature of personhood from these two different theoretical frameworks. And granted this difference in perspectives, I'm not sure, however, that I understand the thinking that comes out of this, this contrast between naturalistic and theological. First, Eastman allows for the idea that both frameworks can speak of the person as relationally or intersubjectively constituted or, in her term, gifted. Okay, so when she says gifted, she's really talking about a kind of intersubjective constitution of the person. And here's an important statement made by Susan Eastman here. She says, but here's the rub. If we take this personal identity to its logical end, apart from any certainty of divine benevolence, we end with horror. Because what is given by other human beings can also be withheld by others. I'll just read that one more time. And here's the rub. If we take this personal identity to its logical end, apart from any certainty of divine benevolence, we end with horror, because what is given by other human beings can also be withheld by others. I call this the horror statement. And I think there's an important claim in here, but I think it really gets confused. Here is Spezio's interpretation of this statement, prioritizing a naturalistic approach to the person that attempts to explain gifted, that is, relationally constituted identities. If we take that naturalistic approach, he says, that relegates the individual person to, at best, an aside, a potential idiosyncrasy that the theory will eventually take over. That is what Eastman means when she warns what is given by other human beings can also be withheld by others. So he sees this statement by Eastman as having to do with the idea of it's better to take a more theological approach than a naturalized approach. First, however, it's not clear why a naturalistic but not a theological attempt to explain gifted identities or identities that are intersubjectively constituted, why that would relegate the individual person to an aside, or what precisely that means. On the inactivist interventionist, interactionist view, the relational autonomy of the individual is required to be maintained for there to be a genuine interaction. So the inactivist would say, we're not doing away with individuals here. Although intersubjective interaction is highly important in the constitution of persons or individuals, the individual should not lose their autonomy. Their autonomy is important for the interaction process to continue. If you take that autonomy away, then there's no true interaction between one person and another. So in the case of slavery, interaction disappears. You're just treated as an object, for example. Second, in making a claim about a certain theoretical perspective, it's not clear how, as Spezio maintains, this claim could be equivalent in meaning to the statement, what is given by other human beings can also be withheld by others. that's a claim about the human condition. So there seems to be a confusion here between a statement about a theoretical perspective, let's call that a T statement, and a statement about human behavior. Call that a B statement. And it's just difficult to see how these two different kinds of statements can be equivalent. Eastman's own statements suggest not an equivalence between the T statement about the theory and the B statement about behavior, but a hypothetical if-then relation. The horror statement comes just after a T statement. She says, "It is possible to speak of personhood as relationally constituted and in this sense gifted without invoking any theological claims, as we have seen in the work of Gallagher, Reddy, Hobson, for example. But here's the rub. If we do so, then we end with horror." So Eastman is claiming that if we accept a naturalistic conception of personhood, even one that captures or tries to capture second-person intersubjective relationality, then we end up with horror, since second-person intersubjective relationality understood naturalistically guarantees nothing. Now, I accept that a naturalistic theory of the human person is no guarantee against denials of humanity or even dehumanization on a massive scale. That's Eastman's phrase. I don't really know anyone who would disagree. But does Paul's anthropology or a theological theory of the person offer such guarantees? One can easily cite some of the same historical evidence of horrors that Eastman cites, the genocidal demonization of people or groups from Armenians to Jews to Tutsis. And of course, the list could expand to include all kinds of terror by people who claim religious justification. Is Paul's theological view some kind of guarantee against such behavior? I think there are three possible interpretations of these statements. First, the claim is that if we develop a naturalistic theory of an embodied relational human person, this will end with horror. But if we develop a theological theory of an embodied relational human person where relationality involves God, the strong claim is that this theory has to be Paul's anthropology and God has to be Jesus, this will not end with horror. But that seems to say simply that if our theory includes God in the right way, then we'll be okay. And that, it seems to me, ordains theory of whatever sort with a power a theory simply doesn't have. That is, if we get our theory right or get the right kind of theory, we will be saved from horror. So if that's not the right way to read it, perhaps it's about what we believe. So here's a second interpretation. If I believe in a theory that does not include God in the right way, then horror. If my theoretical belief does include God in the right way, then no horror. Well, perhaps everything depends on the phrase in the right way. Otherwise, I think history is still full of evidence against this interpretation. Perhaps then the claim is about truth value. So the third interpretation would run, if the naturalistic account without God is true, then horror. Or if the theological account with God as the framework is true, then no horror. On this interpretation, if the theological account is true, then God is the benevolent guarantor. Should we then understand that what is given by God can't be withheld by God? Do we have any certainty of divine benevolence? This may be Paul's view, or it might be Eastman's view as well. It has the constitution of persons in relationship to the lordship of Christ, she says. This has existential traction. But then, what do we do with the historical evidence and, let's say, the ongoing horrors? Perhaps humans have interfered and have taken away what has been given by God. And this is something that Eastman points to. And she asks, why does Paul still warn the Christian converts about the dangers of falling away? And supposedly because humans reject the gift sometime. If that were the case, then, that is, if humans can interfere and have interfered with God's plan, then naturalistic theories may still help to explain why humans go astray, without claiming any guarantees of a full explanation. That is, there still could be, even if you buy into the kind of theological framework, there still could be a place for a naturalistic theory to try to help explain this. This would give flesh to Rudolf Bultmann's phrase, vice versa, when he says, every assertion about God is simultaneously an assertion about man, and vice versa. And Eastman quotes that. Caseman complains about this. He says, the vice versa never receives due attention. So one could ease that complaint precisely by turning to those naturalistic sciences where every assertion is about the human person, and then asking, what do we learn about God from such studies? Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Sean Gallagher, Lillian and Maury Moss Professor of Excellence in Philosophy at the University of Memphis. Professor Gallagher's lecture was titled Personhood and Interpretations of Embodied Cognition and was presented by the Boston University Institute for Philosophy and Religion and the Center for Humanities. Tonight's moderator was Institute for Philosophy and Religion Director David Eckel. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Lee Shuna. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.